You go ahead and tell him.
Yo, just to let y'all know, I forgot to give you a heads up. We got pens and notebooks for anybody that wants to take notes.
I also have pens.
We also have charging stations. There's a couple. Power strips. We got power strips. You need to charge your phone. You need a fucking pen. It's up here.
Thank you, Brandon.
All right, so guys, we're going to start off with each section with a two-minute meditation, and then Tarek's going to guide you in the set-aside prayer.
Okay, just repeat after me. I'm going to say it in sections as we pray.
So don't break into the serenity prayer.
All right, meditation starts now.
Spirit.
We acknowledge your presence here tonight.
We acknowledge your presence here tonight.
We ask that you guide and direct us.
We ask that you guide and direct us.
Please set aside.
Please set aside.
What we think this session will look like.
What we think this session will look like.
What we think we know about the first step.
What we think we know about the first step.
So we can have an open mind.
So we can have an open mind.
And a new experience.
And a new experience.
With these things.
With these things.
Help us see the truth.
Help us see the truth.
Amen.
Amen.
I was having a conversation with a young man outside at the break. I made a comment about medications at the very beginning. It is. So there's one morality, I believe, in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and all 12-step fellowships. If what you're doing is working, keep doing it. If what you're doing is not working, you may want to consider doing something else. Now, the comments I made was in an ideal world, we would come into this process, we would put everything aside, we would go through these steps, we'd make as many amends as we could, We develop a way to take an inventory of ourselves as we walk through the day and develop a fellowship around us that we have transparent dialogue with the people in that fellowship around us, and we share our struggles, and we're an open book, and we don't hide anything. And we learn how to pray, we learn how to meditate, and we sponsor people. And if the symptoms that the meds we're going to treat are still there, then you might need medication. But we don't live in that world. Right? You know, when I got here, I could have been labeled schizophrenic, bipolar, psychotic. Okay, because I was hearing voices. That's what the crack was doing to me. What used to take 5 days of no sleep was happening in a couple of hours. But I was blessed, literally, when the doctor came to the treatment center. I said, I don't want anything. I don't care if I can't sleep. I just don't want anything. That doesn't have to be your story. You know, I'm not going to do anything up here or say anything that's going to limit the power of God. He can work through somebody. But what I have seen over the years, and I don't know if meds cut people off from God. I know that the majority of people I've tried to work with that are on meds are cut off from God. I don't know if the two are connected. But what I heard, and I'll end with this. I spent a half a day with a clinical director at a well-known treatment center for 25 years. She said one of the most amazing things I'd ever heard. She said, you know, in my 25 years, I've noticed something. Addicts and alcoholics always want to take their meds. Mm-hmm. People who need the meds never want to take their meds. Yeah. I turn it over to Brandon.
So I'm going to read this. It's called Beginning. This is the moment of embarking. All auspicious signs are in place. In the beginning, all things are helpful. We prepare ourselves to start anew. Though we may be intent on the magnificent journey ahead, all things are contained in this first moment. Our optimism, our faith, our resolution, our innocence. In order to start, we must make a decision. This decision is a commitment to daily self-cultivation. We must make a strong connection to our inner selves. Outside matters are superfluous. Thank you. It's like my nemesis word. Alone and naked, we negotiate all of life's travails. Therefore, we alone must make something of ourselves, transforming ourselves into the instruments for experiencing the deepest spiritual essence of life. Once we make our decision, all things will come to us. Auspicious signs are not a superstition, but a confirmation. They are a response. It is said that if one chooses to pray to a rock with enough devotion, even that rock will come alive. In the same way, once we choose to commit ourselves to spiritual practice, even the mountains and the valleys will reverberate to the sound of our purpose. So, who thinks that because they showed up at a meeting or they went to a treatment center that they worked their first step? It's all right. Don't be shy. I'm trying to just organize my thoughts of where I want to go or where you guys want me to go. Who thinks that drinking and using is a matter of choice and relapse is a matter of choice?
Be honest, man. There's
guys, it's all right.
Relapse is a matter of choice.
Okay. Who thinks that alcoholism and drug addiction are the same thing? Who's been to treatment before? Who left treatment with a relapse prevention program? Who left with a triggers list? Who was told to watch out for HALT when you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired? I suspect most of you are actually in some sort of program being here, so why did that not work?
Huh?
Because I was not willing to change, I wasn't ready.
Okay. He said because he was not willing to change, he was not ready.
I was going to say because I thought self-knowledge could have been.
Self-knowledge could fix it, yeah.
Those things address the spiritual problem I have.
Okay. He said none of those things fix the spiritual problem. So, if you got your books, if you don't, it's fine. I'll read to you anyways. In the doctor's opinion, it says the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol or drugs interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers or users, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Who in here like went to the club or went somewhere and all they planned on doing was just a little bit?
Yeah.
Did you do just a little bit?
Yeah.
What happened?
I like getting fucked up.
Yeah. See, my experience was like we would go a bunch of families from the neighborhood. We'd go to Mexican on Thursday night. And I could drink one 32-ounce mug of beer and stop. I could do that. But if I ordered a second 32-ounce mug of beer, or I ordered the 40-ounce Texas margarita, when I got home, I kept going. Have you guys looked at your experience and identified anything similar to that? Where like you could intend to do just this much. I don't know the terminology. Throw it out there. The drug.
One's too many.
Yeah. 120 rock.
120 rock, right? Or a couple bars, or... I don't do it justice.
You, yeah. You drive downtown. Your intent to spend $100 on a slab, or spend $100 on a gram of boy,
yeah.
And then you come back up north from North Avenue. At least that's my case. And I get off at Windy Hill, and goddamn it, I smoked my slab, and I've done way too much. And I got to get back on 75 South, and I got to go back downtown. But I thought I told myself I was just going to get that $100 slab. So I think that's what Brandon is trying to.
And you notice you've got an alcoholic trying to describe whatever that was, or an addict trying to describe whatever that was. Okay, now I can hook up with the alcoholics and explain my experience around taking more than 32 ounces of draft beer and what happens, and then later that night you find me in the basement by the beer fridge in the freezer. Eating with my hands,
yeah.
The frozen margarita that's been in the freezer for 3-4 years, but there was nothing else left. Right? I had to have more. We were out of anything else. That's what I was going to do. And the alcoholic, the real alcoholic, gets down with that. If you're not the real alcoholic, you're thinking, dude, just go to bed. Right? I mean, you've been up for 5 days, Tarek. Why don't you just go to bed? Right? Who are the speed users out there?
Damn.
You just stop after like one night, right? Good. I'm tired. I'll go to bed. No, that's not what happens. Right? So I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism and drug addiction is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who have had, for example, worked for a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. Important engagement tomorrow at work. Can't drink very much tonight. One of my favorites, and the horror of this. So we just bought a new house. The entire family's supposed to come over to have Thanksgiving at our house for the first time, big deal, right? Like my sister, her husband coming over, my brother, his wife, my brother's in-laws, my in-laws, everybody's coming over, and we have to eat Thanksgiving dinner at a specific time so that my sister and her husband can get to his family's house to have Thanksgiving dinner again. So the turkeys take a certain amount of time to cook. And so Brandon's job was to turn the oven on. That's it. So I went to the basement, and I was going to stay up and play on PlayStation, NCAA college football, long enough to just turn it on and then just sleep the morning away, right? And so I set like 17 alarms, right? And I wake up with Sarah standing over me, yelling at me with all this noise from all these alarms going off, explaining to me that I have ruined Thanksgiving. I just had to turn the oven on. But I started drinking and went way beyond where I intended to go, and I fell asleep. I always fell asleep. Now that I, from a sober state, can reflect back, I passed out like a motherfucker all the time. But I always thought I fell asleep. So if we go to page 20, if you have your book, if you're not, don't worry, I'll read to you. Moderate drinkers, moderate users have little trouble giving up liquor or drugs entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. So these moderates, normal people, they're fascinating to me, okay? The woman I'm married to now, she is a moderate drinker. She will buy her, she calls it, she'll go get her sixth pack of beer, which is really Mike's Hard Lemonade, and she will open up one of her beers, and Mike's Hard Lemonade, and she will travel the house with that thing. And she'll go into the laundry room, and she'll leave it in there, and she'll say, "I lost my beer." That's your Mike's Hard Lemonade. And then she'll leave it somewhere else, and she'll leave it somewhere else. And I'll come downstairs the next morning, and it's sitting to the right of the sink, and there's this much left. And then that six-pack will stay in the back right corner of the fridge and wreck the way that it's organized for weeks. That's a moderate. Okay, she was having some migraine stuff going on for a little while, and I pointed out that seemed like she was getting more migraines after she drank wine, and she explained to me, no, it's just hormonal stuff. Okay, so it happens again, and I point out, well, you were drinking wine last night. No shitting you. This is the answer. This is what she said. She goes, "I'm not sure if it's the wine or it's the hormones, but I don't like wine enough for me to try to figure it out. I'll just stop drinking wine." What the fuck is that? You know, I keep being late for work and I keep getting fired. I should just stop drinking beer. I said never. Right? Then we have a certain type of hard drinker or hard user. They may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair them physically or mentally. It may cause them to die a few years before their time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man or woman can stop or moderate, although they may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. The example I'll use here, we'll call him Kevin, because that's his name. And this is my buddy from college, Kevin. Like, he was the puke and rally guy. Like, he would disappear, he would come back, and then he would order shots for everybody. And, like, we'd all do the shots, and I'd look at him and go, "You threw up, didn't you?" And he'd go, "Oh, yeah." But he was there to prove that he was sticking it out. He could make it happen. Right? Me, on the other hand, if I threw up, I was done. You're carrying my ass home. Right? But so in those moments of early sobriety when I'm getting excited about sobriety and I want to convert the world to being sober, I start calling all my buddies that I'm pretty certain are alcoholics. So I call Kevin. Kevin. So, like, you guys go to the bar. How often do you go to the bar? Well, not very often. Well, how much do you hang out with Greg? I don't really see Greg that much. And it's like, so what, you just get hammered at the house? It's like, no, man. He's like, I got, you know, Danielle travels a bunch. And, you know, we got chess club and baseball and you know, carpool. And he goes, I just don't have time for it anymore. But this guy used to stay up all night with me. All the time. If a sufficiently strong reason, chess club, Mr. Mom, baseball becomes operative, this man can stop or moderate. Fascinating people. Because they look like me, but they're not me. But what about the real alcoholic? The real addict? They may start off as a moderate. They may or may not become a continuous hard drinker or user. But at some stage in their career, they lose all control once they start. It's fascinating when I want to go back through somebody's experience when I'm sitting down with them working the physical part of the first step. Describe to me what happened at the end when you were drinking. Man, at the end I couldn't stop. Okay, so you couldn't stop at the end. Yeah, but back in high school, I could have a couple and then stop. Okay, but what happened at the end? Well, back in high school, I could have a couple and stop. The problem is that we, alcoholics and addicts, we try to grasp onto that one time where the shit worked. But we don't look at what was going on at the end. Because 2-3 years before the end for me, it looked like I could control it. I was employable, somewhat. But at the end, it was like once Brandon started, Brandon's gone. Every time. So clearly, Brandon's problem is that he just needs to not start, right? So guys, just don't start. All right, we'll see you later. Does that work? If it works, you may not be alcoholic. You may not be addict. But if you can't just not start, Tarek's going to tell you what's going on.
I'm up. Mm-hmm. All right. So these observations that Brandon just made about the physical craving are academic and pointless. And I'm looking. I'm page 23. So these observations about the physical craving would be academic and pointless if Brandon never took the first drink or Tarek never took the first blast off the stem, therefore setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, Brandon and Tarek's main problem centers in their mind rather than their potty. Tarek and Brandon may ask, you know, or somebody that cares about us may ask, but why we started that last bender? The chances are Brandon and I will offer them any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes our excuses have a certain believability or plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc that Tarek and Brandon's drinking and using bouts have created in the past. Okay. Who in here has a really easy time seeing that once I start, once I put a mind-altering substance in my body, whatever your thing is, that you cannot control the amount, that most of the time all bets are off. You don't know how long it's going to last, where you're going to end up, how much money you're going to spend. That's powerlessness, guys, right? That means you've been stripped of the power of choice. If you lose power, you lose choice, you lose control. Can you guys get down with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Who in here has recently relapsed? How many of you think you chose to relapse? How many of those that didn't raise your hand who had a relapse in the distant past believe you chose to relapse?
Okay. Before I knew.
I'm sorry that you believe that.
Not even.
Because pages 23 through 43 are the most misunderstood pages in our big book. Yeah. And so I want you guys to read on with me. Page 24, one of the most important paragraphs, and it's about the idea of choice. The fact is, for guys like Tarek and Brandon, who are addict and alcoholic, for reasons they don't understand, have lost the power of choice in drink and drug. Brandon and Tarek's so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Tarek and Brandon are unable, and these are the three most important words in the paragraph, at certain times to bring into their consciousness, their mind, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and the humiliation and the money that was spent and the relationships that were wrecked of a week ago, a month ago, and with crack and dope and meth, it's a few hours ago.
Consequences.
Right. Tarek and Brandon are without defense against the first drink or drug. So, I'm going to read something else for you guys. There are two types of problem drinkers or drug users, the chronics and the acutes. Acute problem drinkers and drug users have a serious problem. But when they see the destructiveness of their drinking or using and make up their minds to quit, they do, and they stay clean and sober on their own. They don't need to constantly work with others. They don't need to work all 12 steps. They don't need to go to meetings. They sponsor when it is convenient. They pray and meditate when it is convenient. Even though from time to time they may indulge in some of these activities out of convenience. These actions are optional and not a matter of life and death. There might be people in this room that fits their description, and I mean, rock on. Everyone's welcome in these fellowships. I will not turn anyone away. What I'm inviting you to do this weekend is find out what you are. Find out what your truth is. Because here's the deal. Somebody like that that fits that description tries to sponsor a guy like me. They're not trying to hurt me. I know very little. I show up in early recovery. They're driving a really nice car. They got those slogans. And, you know, the slogans blow the top of your head off the first time you hear them. You're like, holy shit.
Do the next right thing.
Who would have thought, right? And I walk up to them, and I say, will you help me? They're not trying to hurt me. They're going to do what was done with them. But if they fit that description and I fit the one I'm about to read, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. Here's where I fit. On the other hand, there's a chronic problem drinker or drug user who no matter what is at stake, no matter how sincere the desire, they eventually suffer from their abstinence to the point where they, in a desperate move, will return to drinking and using time and time again until it eventually kills them. Or they are locked up or they take their own life. These are the people who programs such as AA and CA and HA were designed for. If you can stay clean and sober without it, it's a good thing. But please don't hold that over those that will die without it. The people that welcomed us with love and open arms into a fellowship we didn't need, who knew? You got to find out your truth. And I'm about to walk you guys through this. So, if anyone who considers themselves a student of the Big Book? Okay. In our rooms, we hear the word denial all the time. Okay, denial implies a choice. Because the only way you can deny something is by rejecting it. Everybody thinks addicts and alcoholics suffer from denial. We don't. Our families suffer from denial. We're in the room with our family, and there's an elephant in the room. Family sees elephant in the room. They deny the presence of the elephant. Not my baby.
All right. He's being well educated.
Me and Brandon
he
are
can't have a problem.
Me and Brandon are sitting in the room and we don't even know the elephant's there. That's called delusion, or not being able to tell the difference between what's true and false, or illusion. Words the Big Book authors use. First 164 pages of this Big Book, the word denial is in the book one time in Bill's story, and they're not talking about alcohol. They're talking about him denying God in the sphere of influence when he's having a discussion with his dad. You think that was by mistake? That the authors just didn't put that word in there? And they opted for delusion, illusion, not being able to tell the difference between what's true and false, and obsession. Would everyone in here agree with me that making a choice implies an intellectual sorting out process? Is everybody down with that?
No.
That's how you make it. Like when I got up this morning, I looked in my closet and I intellectually sorted out what I wanted to wear. And I looked at something, I either accepted it or rejected it.
There were three casseroles in there for you to choose from for dinner. You weren't forced into any one of them. You got to choose which one you wanted, correct?
Intellectual sorting out process. Are you guys, okay, are you keeping up? Mm-hmm. All right, this is really, yes, question?
I think some choices happen unconsciously that don't require any intellectual thought.
Okay. Where's the power?
Sorry?
Where's the power then?
If it's unconscious, how's it a choice?
It's not, but I'm saying...
Ah! So hold on a second.
Intellectual sorting out process with the thinking mind. How about that? Good?
So I'm going to give you a real life example here. So... For years, I thought I was choosing to relapse because my moral compass was broken. All right, okay. I thought I'd take that first blast off the stem, and then the second and the third and the fourth, I was making a choice over and over and over to keep going.
Felt like it.
You know, when I knew I shouldn't spend the money, I made a choice to spend the money. Mm-hmm. So I go on this 2-3 day crack run, right? Mm-hmm. I come out of it remorseful, with a firm resolution never to do it again, right? In the hotel room, down at the Travel Lodge on Cortland, looking in the mirror, all sweaty, hadn't showered in 3 days, little tears coming out. I break all the stems, throw all the shit, hook her, get the fuck out, and I cussed. You know, this is part of my experience. You know, I'm not going to sit here and sugarcoat it. This is what I used to do. And I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. Go home, take a shower, go to work. It's Monday, all right? Been at it since Thursday. Get to the office Monday morning. About 10 o'clock, I start to get this vision of this 20 rock on this stem and ripping it. I go through an intellectual sorting out process. No, I don't get paid until Friday. I owe Kevin money for the bills. I got mom's birthday next week. I'm not smoking tonight. I'm not smoking. Boom, it goes away. Holy crap, I just made a choice. Yeah. Intellectual sorting out process. All right. A couple hours go by, it comes back again. I go through the same intellectual sorting out process, pros and cons. I can't do it. I'm not going to do it. Made a choice again. About 3 o'clock, my boy downtown sends me a text and says, I got a slab for you. So I start going through it again. Pros and cons. I make a choice. I ain't doing it. Once again, I can make a choice, and I don't. Funny thing is, about 5 o'clock hits, and I go to the parking garage. I get in my car. I drive down Circle 75 up off Cobb Parkway. Now, here's the thing. I can go straight and go home, and I go left, and I go downtown to North Avenue. That same intellectual sorting out process that I had access to all day long is unavailable to me at that time. I go downtown, I go on another run. Now let's go back to page 24. The fact is that Tarek, for reasons he doesn't understand, has lost the power of choice in using. His so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, unavailable. Tarek is unable at certain times, not all the time, at certain times, I can't bring into my consciousness those pros and cons. What happened last time? If you don't know when the cert time is going to be, how do you protect yourself from that? I didn't make a choice. I didn't have the capacity to make a choice. That's why we don't have a choice before we put any substance in our bodies. And the only thing I have found effective is conscious contact with a power greater than myself that will protect me. I never get to the point where I even have to do the pros and cons anymore. There is no choice. I have about as much choice to get high in a fit spiritual condition as I did to not get high in an unfit spiritual condition before I worked the 12 steps. These are the most misunderstood pages in our big book. Every story that we run across, the exceptional man, Jim, Fred, the jaywalker, they all think they had a choice. They all thought they had a choice. When I learned and I experienced this paragraph in a big book study in my first year, it changed my life. Because you know what it told me? I have to do this just like I smoke crack because I don't know when the certain times are coming for me. Yeah. See, there's someone in here tonight that thinks they know what circumstances have to take place in their lives that make them get high again. Mm-hmm. If my mom and dad die, I'm getting high. Mm-hmm. If one of my kids dies, I'm getting high. You know, if I lose everything, I'm getting high. So if those things don't happen, I ain't going to get high. We don't know what the day looks like, but the mind of an addict, an alcoholic, will try to convince you, I know what that situation looks like. And then we'll try to protect ourselves by controlling.
Triggers list.
Yeah, triggers list. Yeah. So, this is very important, because if you see this, if you've been stripped of power, choice, and control, you've got the triple crown. They ain't coming back.
Yeah.
They're not coming back. Who in here thinks that there is such a thing as triggers? I'm just curious. That if you stay away from your triggers, you won't get high and you won't drink. Okay, let's do this. Here's the exercise. Who in here got high when their life looked like crap? Who in here got high when their life looked pretty good? Who in here got high when they had a spouse? Who in here got high when they were alone? Who in here got high when they were depressed? Who in here got high when they were happy? Who in here got high with money in your pocket? Who in here got high when you were broke? Huh. I thought there was such a thing as a trigger. The only real trigger is the internal condition, which Brandon's about to talk about. I mean, hell, waking up and taking a real deep breath was a trigger.
Yeah.
Oxygen.
You know, but for years, 3 years of going in and out of treatment, and I got these triggers list, and I didn't understand why it never worked. Because I never addressed the problem. Which is a broken internal condition that I cannot remedy on my own. Now, I'm not talking to everybody in the room. Not everybody fits that description, because the one thing I want to read real quick, page 34. Second full paragraph. For those who are unable to drink or use drugs recreationally or moderately, the question is how to stop forever. That's what altogether means.
Huh.
We are assuming, of course, that Tarek has a desire to stop. Whether Tarek can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which Tarek has already lost the power to choose whether he will use or not. There's a spectrum here, people, and in the back of the book in the chapter to the wise, which Brandon usually covers beautifully, there's four types of drinkers and users, and we all fit somewhere on that spectrum, and the closer you are to a type four, the more you've lost the power of choice to that degree, and the closer you are to a type four, the deeper you got to do this work. The thing is, our fellowships are full of all types. That's why you got to find out and get with your people. You know, I know who my kissing cousins are, and I know who my immediate family is in the rooms, because I don't ever want to get to a point where I'm hanging out with people that don't have to do the work that I have to do to stay in conscious contact with my Creator, and then I hit a dark spot in my life, and my mind starts to tell me, you know, Joe over here, man, he has not made all his amends, and he doesn't have a daily prayer meditation life, and he sponsors every once in a while, and he just seems to be okay. You know, maybe I can do what Joe does. I don't want that to ever be a possibility to creep back in my life. I have, and one of the questions I want to leave you guys with is, are you attacking recovery like you attacked dope, like you attacked crack or meth or alcohol? I don't care what your deal is. Isn't it funny? We call ourselves mad dogs out there, and then we get in here and we turn into this little ankle biter dog that you just want to kick. And you're a rabid Rottweiler out in the street. It's fascinating to watch. Why is that? I don't think they see page 24. I know I cannot quit on a non-spiritual basis. There's got to be a lot of God in my life. There's going to be a lot of crack cocaine in my life. That's it. That's it. Once I was able to see that, it was a crushing blow. It snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job on my own. And until that flicker is gone, which is synonymous with being reduced to nothing, I will still try to fix the problem myself. Or I will be convinced that if I solve all these other problems, it'll solve this problem of drugs and alcohol. But my experience abundantly confirms to me that every time I make a resolution, I can't keep it. And there were many days in my experience where I made a choice not to, and I did anyway. That's powerlessness, folks. Doing something you don't want to do I don't know about you guys, but in my using experience of 17 years, there were many times I got high when I knew it was in my best interest not to get high, setting off the terrible cycle again. This is what we're dealing with. This is true powerlessness. You have to have the physical powerlessness that Brandon described, coupled with the mental powerlessness that I am describing, that makes you powerless. That's the first half of the first step. The big book uses 54 pages. It's pretty important. All right, once you see that powerlessness go and the hopelessness, and I have to cuss right now because I'm going to give you the short version of the first step is I am fucked. That's the short version of the first step. But once I see that and I see the hopelessness, it's the first glimmer of hope. That's the paradox, one of many paradoxes that we have in our program. The more hopeless you are, the better chance there is for you. The better chance there is. So let's talk about the breeding ground for this obsession to return. And Brandon's going to take over now.
So I heard when I got here early on that the first step is about hope, right? If I've got a solid sponsor and they've taken me through the first half, we're just talking about the first half of the first step, there is no hope for me. What I see is Brandon's default position is drunk every time. You can change the people, you can change the circumstances, you can change everything. Brandon's drunk. Okay? Now, who in here thinks that if somebody does drugs, they're an addict? Okay? The world out there thinks that anybody that has ever done drugs must be an addict. If that was the case, then anybody that ever drank a beer must be an alcoholic, right? Who has the ability to take or leave alcohol alone in this room? Okay? Who in here has the ability to take or leave certain drugs and leave them alone? Okay? Who in here, when they start drinking, they can't leave it alone? Who in here, when they start using, they can't leave it alone? Okay, now, if you answered yes to some, like yes to alcohol, that you could leave it alone, but drugs you could not, you're an addict. This is the real simple way. There's a much more complicated way. You're an addict. You're not an alcoholic. Vice versa. So alcoholics and addicts are not the same thing. The steps are the same for them, but you better find somebody that you identify with that knows your stuff. I don't sponsor addicts because I can't tell exactly when they're starting to get squirrely. An alcoholic gets across from me, dude, I know he's getting drunk well before he knows it. It's clear to me because I know the mindset. Now, if somebody's been through the steps or they've reached a certain level, I'll sponsor an addict because the identification isn't that important. We'll talk more about that maybe later on in the weekend. So, in the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like or use essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol and drugs. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they after a time cannot differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic or addict life seems the only normal one. They are restless or
uneasy.
Uneasy. They're irritable or
easily annoyed.
Discontented or
not satisfied.
And unless they can experience the same sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, lines, or hits, things that they see others experiencing, until they find something to replace that, they're fucked. Every time. Every single time. So, but how do I do that? Okay? So, what we've identified is, in order to be a real alcoholic, when you start, you can't stop. And when you stop, you can't stay stopped. And in order to be a real addict, when you start, you can't stop. And when you stop, you can't stay stopped. That encapsulates what a real alcoholic or what a real addict is. Now, let's see if anybody subscribes to this. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Anybody got any of that going on?
Yeah.
Couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. Couldn't seem to make a living. Had a feeling of uselessness. Full of fear. We were unhappy. Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Now, how many of you does that exist? Drunk or sober, high or clean? That is the spiritual malady. Okay? What's important is so many people come in and they look at the dash in the first step and they say, I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. My life is unmanageable. My life is unmanageable because of the drugs and alcohol. Well, if that's the case, just stop. And then your life's manageable, right? There's a time period somewhere between a year and 2 years that is where most people go out. They can work the steps, and then unmanageability starts to creep in. I'm a year and a half, 2 years sober. Life isn't great right now. I know it'll fix that. Okay? The number of people that we lose after the first year that have actually worked the steps and before year three is baffling. Life starts to come back a little bit. She came back. Job came back. Money coming back. What we start to do is we start to take credit for the things that have happened in our lives instead of maybe realizing that some power was doing that in our lives, and we lose sight of what we're talking about and we're gone. Yeah. And we're gone well before we're actually gone. The relapse ends when we pick up. It ends. It starts somewhere in unmanageability well before that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so spiritual malady for me does not necessarily mean that the spirit can get sick. Spirit can't be sick. Spirit is spirit. It's separation. Conscious separation from any imaginative thinking that there is a presence with me. No relationship. I don't see God. And this happened to me at 18 months. I have no mental obsession because I described it exactly like Brandon. My mental obsession makes my life unmanageable. I can't pay my bills. I can't have a relationship. I lose my house. I file bankruptcy, blah, 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 because I have a mental obsession to get high. Well, 18 months, there's no mental obsession to get high. There's a ton of stress in a lot of my personal relationships. I probably could have been put on some bipolar medication. I am hunted by misery, not so much depression. But here's the thing. I was taking advantage of manipulating my parents. My sex life was a train wreck. When I sat at home, I had the TV on. My laptop would be open with music. And I'm on the phone with one of you in the program trying to figure out what you're doing because I didn't want to stay at home by myself. I couldn't stand to be alone by myself. But yet I was sponsoring five or six guys. I was uneasy, easily annoyed, and I wasn't satisfied. I started to get bored in recovery. I was like, what is going on? I'm sponsoring people, and I'm miserable. And then I put in this CD, and this guy, God rest his soul, Mark Houston, he gets on this CD, and he starts talking about, he goes, I love meetings that start with meditation. And he goes on and describes 10 and 11. And I'm a big book guy, and I was like, man, what book is this dude reading out of? So I like turned it back open, and I was like, man, this guy is right. And then this other dude with one patch over one eye, he gets on this CD and he starts talking about the spiritual malady. And he describes what I'm experiencing at 18 months. It fascinated me. And so I got really excited. I wanted to find some people that knew these two guys. And I did. And I went back through the steps and I realized something. That I had not experienced a surrender to self. I was hitting bottom with the second half of the first step at 18 months with the unmanageability, right? Because on some level, deep down inside, I still, with a sliver, thought drugs and alcohol were the core of the problem, right? I didn't realize it was a character problem. All right, sorry.
Oh, you're good.
Another reason that we lose a lot of people on page 70, the first full paragraph, it's in the sex inventory, but I think it applies to so many other things. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. All of us have a vision of what we want out of each thing that we're in, relationships, jobs, recovery, what have you. So we create a vision, an ideal. If we fall short of that, does that mean that we're going to get drunk or high? Some people tell us so, but it's only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, maybe rework the steps, we believe we will have been forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and we continue to do the same shit over and over and over and over and over again to people, we're quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So there's a bunch of you in this room that have been sober and done reasonably well at it. Okay? I hear often from people, I've only got 6 months this time, but I had 2 years before. I only have a year and a half this time, but I had 6 years before. Okay. Let me change that for you. And this is something that came to me earlier, and I think it was maybe earlier this week. So, if you ask me, how long have you been married to Carrie? And my response is, well, Carrie and I met back in 2012, and then we got married in 2014. But Sarah and I, we met back in like 1997. We dated for like 3 years, and then we were actually married for 11. Would that be confusing? You asked me how long I was married to Carrie, and I explained this other relationship with this person that you've never even heard of named Sarah. If I bring something other than my current experience into our conversation, it confuses the hell out of stuff.
Mm. Oh, damn.
So there's all these people that they want to tell you what they used to have. Let's be real clear. You don't have it now. I probably, over the course of my life, have had several hundreds of thousands of dollars. I do not currently have that money. Okay? So don't claim what you don't have. What that is your mind trying to twist things to tell you that you've done something that you didn't really do. The experience was corrupted. The minute you picked up, the experience was corrupted. What do you have right now? That's what we're talking about. And that malady within you wants to try to bring all sorts of things to claim that you're bigger and better than you are. The strange thing is, once you treat the spirit, you don't care. You are who you are. So what does it look like? We've kind of told you some of these things of gone through the unmanageability. What does that look? What does it look like when spirit works? Not many people that can tell you that, because when spirit works, you're usually not paying attention. But I have a very specific time period that I can tell you, and this is it. My parents live out at the lake. I'm the grill master. Everybody else is hammered and ruins the meat. So I am the grill master. The grill sits down a couple steps from the back patio, and there's a rec room at the end of the back patio where the beer fridge is. Always stocked full of beer. Everybody's upstairs in the kitchen. They're having a good old time laughing and carrying on. I'm down at the grill by myself. End of a perfect day. Nothing wrong. Life is wonderful. Lights coming off the lake just right. Perfect temperature, probably like, 70s. Thought crosses my mind, it would be nice to have a beer. My default response to it would be nice to have a beer is like, you're not capable of having a beer. You always have a ton. Thought stays. I could walk down that patio, go grab a beer. Nobody would know. Even if they found out, they'd probably be happy anyways, because I'm finally their drinking buddy again. Thought stays. Shouldn't do this. Thought stays. I should probably call somebody. Thought stays. So that's Saturday night. Monday, I'm sitting meeting with a sponsee, and I'm explaining this situation to him. And he said, so what'd you do? He's like, what do you mean? He goes, what'd you do? I go, I don't understand. He goes, well, you're not drunk, right? I'm like, no. He goes, did you call somebody? No. Did somebody come and interrupt you? No. What happened? I don't know. I don't know if a boat came roaring through the cove. I don't know if the grill fired up. I don't know if somebody came down the stairs. I don't know what happened. But I didn't drink. That's what it looks like when Spirit intercedes. There was no choice. Mm. The only reason why I remember this experience is because I was explaining it to a sponsee, and if he hadn't asked me the question, what did you do, I would have no idea. What does it look like when the choice has been removed from you?
Can I tell them? Mm-hmm. So to the New Year's Eve 2014, I'm at a panic show at Phillips Arena, and I'm surrounded by people who are doing key bumps of Molly, key bumps of Coke. They're tubing finger dips. They're eating vials, LSD everywhere, ecstasy everywhere, pot everywhere, right? Continuously being offered to me. Recoil like a hot flame, and my boy's with me, and he's been in and out. And he turns to me at one point when some dude offered him something, and he turned it down. He leaned over to me, and he's like, man, God, I want to so bad, man. Don't you? That's how Spirit works. I said, no. I said, man, that stuff's like invisible to me. I don't have a desire. It's just not there, and I'm not doing anything to keep, like, there's something else protecting me, safe and protected. Right? He relapsed shortly after that. That's how Spirit works. You know, but Brandon and I can sit up here and talk about this process till we're blue in the face. The reality is no one's going to... We can't give you our experience as much as we would like, but you have to go through the process and have your own experience. And then it will confirm to you. It, you know, convinces you. We're going to do our best to share our experience in hope of walking you down a path to you looking at your own experience, which will perhaps convince you that you got to take this course of action. That's all we can do.
If you don't have somebody in your life, like a sponsor, challenging you on all these concepts, fire your current sponsor. Get a new one. It's only your life. No big deal, right? I was going to finish.
Yeah,
So we usually... spend a lot more time really hammering the first step because we think it's that important. Guys that I take through the steps that we go through the book, I mean, we may be on the first step for 3, 4, 5 weeks. 6 weeks, maybe. says one. To really understand what you're up against, because relapse happens for one reason alone. The failure to connect with your first step, which usually comes in the form of some sort of dishonesty. Okay? If you don't see reason to be totally transparent with somebody and to let everybody come into your experience, you ain't staying. There's very little of that happens in my life that I won't share openly in a forum like this, unless it's in bad taste. There's some of that stuff in my experience that I just... It affects other people that I can't share. Okay? I feel compelled to say this at this moment, and I have no idea why, but... I've listened to enough fifth steps between alcoholics and addicts to identify that there are two things that almost... invariably show up in one and almost invariably show up in the other. Okay? And I'm not going to say all of them because that would be breaking the anonymity of everybody that I've ever listened to their fifth step. But I don't recall too many alcoholics who haven't had just terrible relationships that are... they've been out there cheating on everybody that's they've ever been in a relationship with. I don't know too many alcoholics that hasn't showed up. The other thing that almost invariably always shows up. So those of you who think you're going to keep this one and never share it with anybody, the experience of addicts is that pretty much every addict who is a straight male has had some sort of homosexual experience with another male or female, vice versa. It's in so many more than it's not. So for those of you who are thinking that I'm going to be honest about everything but that, probably going to drink over it. Probably going to use over it. Okay? Because and you're going to go back and you're going to look at your buddies tonight and you're going to be like, did you? Just don't do that, because this would be kind of a weird car ride or whatever. So anyway, I'm going to close out our little first step experience here with this reading from a guy named Paul F., who I have no idea who he is.
Just
tell me his name. Who was it? This is called Reflections of Step 1 by Paul F. My experience and attitude with steps 2 through 12 is simply a reflection of what I experienced in step 1. If I am honest with myself in step 1, I cannot escape the truth. I cannot escape the reality that there is nothing I can do to keep myself clean and sober. I will see that I am guaranteed to drink or use again. There is no hope in step one. I will digest the truth that I do not have the power to choose whether I will or will not drink or use. Relying on my memory of suffering to keep me sober or clean is no longer an option. My better judgment and greater intellect will not produce a mental defense against the first drink or drug. As a result of my experiencing the first step, rather than it being an intellectual exercise, I am in touch with my powerlessness at a gut level. This tends to produce discomfort. This discomfort is a gift. This very gift promotes a desire to seek power, which I do not possess. This discomfort is not to be confused with fear of being the motivation to stay sober or clean. To rely on fear to stay clean or sober is dangerous, for the day will come when the fear will disappear, and then there will be no reason for me to stay clean and sober. To be honest, in my first step is to surrender completely. I am surrendering to the fact that I have no power. This surrender is what produces the hope and the promises in the remaining steps. Without this surrender, I will not experience an entire psychic change, nor will I experience the many gifts that the big book authors talk about. As a result of now having the desire to seek power, I am much more motivated to establish a relationship with a power greater than myself. If I have difficulty with the higher power concept or a belief in some kind of God in step two, it is generally because I am clinging to the idea that I have power. It is a blatant sign that I have overlooked something crucial in my first step. If I did not experience the powerlessness at a gut level, I would not be eager to seek that power. After having the first step experience, I will not balk at making a decision in step three to turn my will and my life over to some kind of power greater than myself. Keeping in mind that this decision is basically says I am willing to do steps 4 through 12 in their entirety. If step one was an intellectual exercise, I will not see the urgency with step three. This first step experience and my desire to seek power promotes the willingness to do an honest and thorough inventory, because I now know how the stark reality I'm facing. I must have these things removed so I can gain access to some power which will save my life. I am willing to tell someone else my entire life story, and I will not leave any stone unturned. My experience with step one will allow me to see that I am facing a life and death decision. Without that experience in step one, I will not truly understand the seriousness of my malady, and I will balk at doing an inventory, or I will take shortcuts so I can get over with it, or I'll take forever to do it. Forever is more than a month or two. by the way. My first step experience promotes eagerness to share my inventory. I am eager to get the truth to the truth so I can be free. I cannot intellectually produce the eagerness if I do not experience step one at a visceral level. As a result of my first step experience and the hope I experienced in steps 2 through 5, I am eager to take the exact nature of my wrongs to God in steps 6 and 7. I want them removed so I can stay clean and sober and be free of the things that have caused me the failure and defeat. Without a first step experience, I will see these steps as mere stepping stones for bigger and better things to come. I am much more willing to make a list of all the people I have harmed and much more willing to finish my amends as a result of experiencing the seriousness of my malady in step 1. It will become crystal clear that I will die if I do not go to any lengths to repair the damage I have caused. If my experience with step 1 is an intellectual one, I will have a casual attitude about making amends. I will tell myself that I will make these amends when the situation presents itself, or I may convince myself that I will not die if I take another drink or drug again, and I can always get sober or clean again. I will also practice this thing called living amends, which is nowhere in the big book, which we'll talk about later. From my experience with making amends as a result of my first step experience and the hope I experience in the following steps, I am much more motivated to do a daily 10th step. My spirit knows how essential it is to maintain contact with the power that enables me to stay sober. Without a visceral experience in step 1, I will not see step 10 as something, I will see step 10 as something I can take or leave. At this point, I am eager to establish and maintain a relationship with God of my understanding. I look forward to my meditation practices. I am energized and enthusiastic about this relationship. I want to learn about this God that I really do not understand. Without a first step experience, I will view meditation and prayer as a chore, and I will not see how essential it is for me to have access to the power that I hear others talking about. It is abundantly clear that I must pass this on to others or I will die. I am eager to work with others. I look forward to taking others through the steps, and I am enthusiastic about the process. I am energized and often feel like I am on fire with something that I have never before could have even imagined. Now I understand why they say the loneliness will vanish, and this will be the bright spot of my life. Without a first step experience and the experience of the following steps, there will be minimal desire to work with others. When asked why I don't sponsor others, I will say no one has asked me. I will not have the necessary motivation to take it upon myself to seek out the newcomer. I will be lazy. I will sit back and express how grateful I am that the of what the program has given me. I will lack the motivation to give back what was so freely given me. Even though there have been times when I have been resistive and balked at various times in the steps, the quantity and willingness and eagerness produced through the process has far outweighed my reluctance. Now I fully understand why I was taken through the steps so quickly. I did not have time to think about my experience. I simply experienced it. As a result of this experience, the compulsion to drink and use was removed in a very short period of time. Maybe that is why they say the steps are to be experienced rather than understood, and our experience through the steps will give us that the understanding. For that, I'm eternally grateful. And I could never in my life repay Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous or HA for what you have so freely given me. I wish to thank all of you for your help. I am neither cocky nor am I afraid. I am free. Right. Take a 15-minute break and come back with a speaker.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Thanks, sir. That's a good one.